3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. British police released the names of two of three attackers who killed seven and wounded dozens late Saturday in London. They're identified as 27-year-old Briton Karam Shahzad Butt, a native of Pakistan and previously known to authorities, and 30-year-old Rashid Redouin. The third attacker's identity has not been released. Scotland Yard Commander Mac Chisty appealed to anyone who may have information on the attackers to come forward.
Unlike a single person, a lone wolf type of attack who may keep everything to themselves, when you've got three people in concert, necessarily there must have been some discussion around that, and some people, even at the closest point to them, must have known something. And we're saying they had a duty, the Muslim community saying they had that duty to report it.
The Islamic State claimed responsibility for Saturday's attack. Thousands attended a vigil late Monday at London City Hall to honour the victims.
Why wouldn't it be important? How could anybody ignore this? Tragic. It's tragic for all the lives that are lost, including the three.
It was absolutely barbaric. This doesn't represent Islam. It's been said countless times before. This isn't the first time something like this has happened in the UK or America as well. But we reject it completely. We condemn it in the utmost way.
It's about love and unity and coming together. And we have to now more than ever show compassion towards one another.
Campaigning ahead of Thursday's election in Britain resumed Monday. The U.S. has called on the United Nations to investigate the murders of two U.N. sanctions monitors in Democratic Republic of Congo. American Michael Sharp and Zeta Catalan of Sweden disappeared in March in the DRC's central Kasai region. This is VOA News. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Yemen, and Maldives have cut ties with Qatar, accusing it of supporting terrorism. Qatar's foreign ministry said the measures are unjustified. But Middle East Institute scholar and former U.S. Ambassador David Mack said he believes there is some truth to the charge.
Qatar has provided a certain amount of political support and perhaps in many cases some financial support to the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas. And so I think there is truth in that.
Control risks analyst Allison Wood in Dubai said the decision came just weeks after President Donald Trump addressed Arab and Muslim leaders in Riyadh.
This is particularly the case off the back of the recent Riyadh summit that they had with President Trump when he visited Saudi Arabia, and recent meetings that have happened between the leaders of both the UAE and Saudi Arabia with the U.S. I think they probably felt like they were in a position of strength and had certain levels of endorsement from the U.S. for some of these issues, such that they could use this as an opening to pressure Qatar into coming more in line with their own policy positions.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said he does not expect Monday's action to have an impact on the fight against terrorism in the region or globally. The U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, said it plans to announce Tuesday the start date for the final assault on the Islamic State-held Syrian city of Raqqa. David Lesh, a Trinity University Syria analyst, said the final charge has long been coming but is fraught with challenges.
Because of the mixture of forces, because of the nature of the Syrian Democratic Forces, i.e. the Kurdish component, and of course U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkey's interests in that area, northern Syria, in addition to Russia and of course the Syrian regime, which just retook a city of its own, you know, west of Raqqa.
Raqqa, the last bastion of the self-proclaimed IS caliphate in 2014, the group also faces defeat in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul, where the UN Children's Fund warned Monday some 100,000 children trapped in dangerous conditions are often used as human shields. Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said that police are treating a deadly siege in Melbourne as an act of terror. Police shot dead the gunman, identified as Yakub Kaira, Monday after he held a woman hostage inside an apartment building.
This terrorist attack by a known criminal, a man who was only recently released on parole, is a shocking, cowardly crime.
Police say the gunman, acquitted of a plot to attack a Sydney Army base in 2009, shot dead a man in the apartment building. U.S. actor and comedian Bill Cosby went on trial Monday on charges he drugged and sexually assaulted a woman more than a decade ago. The 79-year-old former television star faces three counts of aggravated indecent assault. Each carry a maximum sentence of 10 years in jail and a $25,000 fine. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia hails the just concluded ECOWAS summit as a success both in economic and security terms.
It shows that ECOWAS has proven to be this regional body that has capacity to promote regional development in the areas of trade, in the areas of regional integration, in the areas of political harmonization.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's Minister of Information. A ceasefire signed over the weekend appears to be holding in South Sudan's war-torn Yei River State. A report out this week shows widespread corruption in Uganda's mining industry, and Cameroon's main opposition leader says he knows of no overture for dialogue from longtime leader Paul Biya.
They call me the main opposition leader. Mr. Biya has not had the courtesy to invite me to find out my own opinion of what is actually happening.
Ni John Frundi is leader of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. And Somalia finds itself in a diplomatic dilemma after several friendly countries broke ties with Carter. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia is holding the just-concluded Economic Community of West African States ECOWAS Summit, held over the weekend in Monrovia, as a success both in economic and security terms. Liberia's Information Minister Eugene Nambwe says the success shows the growing influence of the regional body in terms of promoting regional development, integration, and political harmonization. Nambwe says because of the growing influence of ECOWAS, a number of non-West African countries like Morocco have sought membership or observer status. Nambwe says the presence of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu provided one of the highlights of the summit, with Israel promising to invest $1 billion to advance solar power projects in 15 ECOWAS countries, beginning with Liberia, to fund rural electrification.
The first economic benefit that we have is that Israel signed a $1 billion pact with ECOWAS. And this fact is that Israel will provide $1 billion for us to deploy and expand partly in solar energy. And the first project of this $1 billion will be done in Liberia in the next couple of months, where with $20 million of solar fuel will be established in Liberia to cater to the fact that there is a lack of electricity in our rural areas. So the electricity grid will be extended to the rural areas, utilizing this $20 million project to provide electricity to cover about 25% of our capacity or our lack of capacity so that our rural people can benefit from electricity.
In the area of security, what would you say?
You know, regarding security, the Prime Minister of Israel did offer to ECOWAS that Israel has the capacity, the technology to help Africa, West Africa in particular, to handle some of the issues that we have with terrorism, with the illegal fishing on our water, with the use of ICT to determine how we can deal with some of these problems. So the visit was very fruitful, and we are proud that the Prime Minister Netanyahu came to West Africa, and in particular came to Liberia.
Now, I was reading about ECOWAS troops in the Gambia. What was the decision there?
No, ECOWAS troops in Bissau, because there is a political stalemate. And in this meeting, the heads of state urged Guinea-Bissau and all of the parties, including the Prime Minister, the President, and the political parties to continue to work towards peace and to adhere and comply with the Conakry Accord that calls for resolution of the political crisis that will ultimately lead to the hosting of elections that will be free and fair and would afford the people of Guinea-Bissau to elect their leaders.
Morocco was approved as a member of ECOWAS. I was wondering, what are the benefits of Morocco becoming a member of ECOWAS?
Well, the formality of Morocco's accession to ECOWAS will be done in the coming months. But in principle, the leaders agree that Morocco should become a part of our regional community. But the benefits are the fact that ECOWAS has performed so much well that other people from outside of the region, in North Africa, in Morocco, in Tunisia, wanting to be observers, Tunisia coming to speak to our leaders. It shows that ECOWAS has proving to be this regional body that has the capacity to promote regional development in the areas of trade, in the areas of regional integration, in the areas of political harmonization.
Who is the new chair of ECOWAS to succeed President Sirleaf? Okay. Was there an election at all, or was the leadership by acclamation?
Well, the normal protocol that ECOWAS has is to consult and find a consensus. And then through the consensus and through the discussions among the leaders, full acclamation of all of the leaders, the President of the Republic of Togo, Mr. Foreign Assembly, was elected as the head of ECOWAS, and he took the baton of authority from President Sirleaf. Now, what is most important is that the harmonization of all of these, where the chair of the authorities of head of state, in this case, President Sirleaf, handed over power in a gracious manner to President Foreign Assembly, is a sign of how West Africa and the ECOWAS region should promote the peaceful transfer of power in democracy.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The leader of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party says he knows of no overture to the opposition by the country's longtime leader, Paul Biya, for dialogue to address the ongoing political crisis in the country. Cameroon has been embroiled in social unrest, from medical doctors' strike over pay to the dominance of French in the country's English-speaking region. Over the weekend, President Paul Biya said his government was willing to listen to the demands of the people and negotiate if the requests were legitimate. But opposition leader Ni John Frundi says the government has sidelined him in any attempt to find solutions to the crisis.
They call me the main opposition leader. Mr. Biya has not had the courtesy to invite me to find out my own opinion of what is actually happening. He said his prime minister, they came to discuss issues, agreed with the consortiums of the teachers and the lawyers' union on what to do. Just the day they were to meet, sign their agreements, the consortiums were banned and their leaders arrested, and those that were not arrested are on the run till today. So up till now, Mr. Biya has been deceiving himself that schools have reopened. Meanwhile, no school is reopened in the north and southwest. He tells the world that Cameroon is one and indivisible. And what they've done is to get Francophone children to go to school. And if Francophone children can go to school in an Anglophone area to heal, everything is okay. And he says Cameroon is one and indivisible. Who is dividing Cameroon? The one who's telling lies that schools have reopened, meanwhile, they're just Francophones going to school, or the people who want a better educational system and legal system for the country.
Mr. Frundi, you said that the president went and met with protesters and their leaders, and you, the main opposition leader, nobody came to talk to you. Is it because the government realizes that the protesters will not listen to you?
The protesters are not listening to them. And the protesters have given their points of agreement to state exactly what they want the government to do, which are legitimate. But the government said they must listen to what they want to give them and not what they want. I think that if you have a child and you are giving conflict to that child and the child is refusing and throwing out, you have to find out what the child likes.
When the president says that he's willing to dialogue, provided the requests are legitimate, I'm assuming that he is referring to the demand by some of the activists and the protesters calling for the establishment of a two-state federation. What do you think about that whole idea of a two-state federation in Cameroon?
When the protesters started, they were not out for the political side of it, the federal system. They wanted just the issues of education and the legal system. It's when they refuse this and push them to the wall. They say, okay, we want a federal system so that we can have our issues done the way we want. And some activists that have been pushed to the wall, beaten their relatives' killed, say that they don't want even a federation, they want secession. You see, when you push people to the wall, they are forced to talk hard language. And whatever happens is that Biya will be held responsible.
President Biya, we said to his credit, during the protests, he signed a decree establishing the National Commission of Bilingualism and Multiculturalism to solve the problem. Is this satisfactory to you or maybe to the protesters?
He is taking us in the wrong direction, sir. The Cameroonian problem is not been bilingualism. It's not been multiculturalism. There are about 250 cultural groups in Cameroon. We are talking of something between Anglophone, Francophone. When you try to culturalize it or bring it to tribal ethnic groupings, you are missing the point. It's just trying to water it down. It's not facing what Anglophones are talking about.
Ni John Frundi is leader of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. He was speaking with me from London, United Kingdom. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 6. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send shout out to our affiliate stations, Rush FM and Radio Hot Cocoa in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. A ceasefire has taken effect in South Sudan's war-torn Ye River state. The deal was signed Sunday in Uganda between a breakaway faction from the SPLA in opposition and the government. But top opposition SPLM-IO leaders say they do not recognize the deal. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
The peace agreement for Ye River State came after a four-day joint military committee meeting in Kampala to discuss a cessation of hostilities, permanent ceasefire, national dialogue, and the opening of all roads leading to and from Ye Town in South Sudan. The key agreement was the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition agreed to declare a permanent ceasefire and for both sides to ensure Ye River State is not a battleground. Brigadier General Hilary Edson Yakani represented the SPLA in opposition and explained some of their demands.
We have seen that there are a lot of challenges, especially from the behavior of some military persons who were misusing their positions in mishandling our citizens. So this is one of our greatest demands, asking the government to bring in a well-balanced national army who really handle people with all respect and what is really required of a national army.
Lead government negotiator Major General Marshal Stephen Babanen says the agreement signed Sunday is going to be fully operational in 18 weeks, including the integration of the former rebels into the National Army.
We have signed the agreement and the permanent ceasefire. They are going to move to pre-assembly areas, which will take them 1 to 2 weeks. And then in the third week, they will go to the assembly area where all activities of screening, training and integration will take place.
But when VOA contacted the main opposition SPLM-IO deputy spokesman, Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel, he said they do not recognize the group led by Brigadier General Yakani. Gabriel said those who signed the fake peace deal are individuals who deserted opposition leader Riek Machar. But Yakani says he represents more than 16,000 armed troops in Ye River State.
When we went to the booth, we did not sign a document with Riek Machar, but we all went to the booth because there was a problem. So now that we are coming back, we command the forces in Ye River State. It's not Riek Machar who commands the forces.
The agreement was a result of a request from South Sudan's President Salva Kiir to Uganda's Yoweri Museveni. The grassroots peace initiative process follows a January visit to Ye by Kiir. Ye was a headquarter of the SPLA during the struggle with Sudan and has been at the heart of the fighting in South Sudan. The UN Human Rights Office released a report in May alleging pro-government forces killed at least 114 civilians in and around Ye Town from July 2016 to January 2017. The army has denied these allegations. Ye Town was considered mostly peaceful until the flare-up of violence in July 2016 following Machar's departure from Juba. Since that time, many residents have fled, often to refugee settlements in neighboring Uganda. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
A report out this week by Global Witness shows what the group says is widespread corruption throughout Uganda's mining industry, especially in the gold sector. According to the 18-month-long investigation, the country is illegally granting mining licenses to protected sites such as Mwindi, which is home to 50% of the world's remaining mountain gorillas. Josh Bowden, Uganda campaign leader for Global Witness, talked to Ricky Shryak about the environmental risks, poor working condition, and loss of government revenue as a result of corruption.
What we've discovered as part of this is that Uganda's mining sector is completely dominated by corruption, mismanagement, and political influence. And what that's leading to is both problems in terms of working conditions for those that work in the sector and for the human rights of people who are forced to make way for some of these mining ventures. But also it's posing a real risk to the environment. And probably the starkest example of that is the fact that the government department, the mines department, has been issuing exploration licenses across almost all of Uganda's protected areas, including two UNESCO World Heritage sites, Gwindi and Rwenzori. And not only are they protected by international convention, but Gwindi is home to 50% of the world's remaining mountain gorillas. So, you know, clearly there's real problems in the way that the sector is being managed.
And I could see from an economic standpoint, if someone wanted to come in and say, but the people of Uganda are benefiting, there are some well-paying jobs that are being provided. Is this the case, or is this not the case as well, that workers are not benefiting?
I mean, we absolutely agree that, you know, mining could be a real opportunity for Uganda, both in terms of bringing in revenues for the state that could pay for public services, but also in terms of creating much needed jobs for a really fast growing population. What we've seen is that investors are being put off because of the nature of the way that the sector is run, because of the corruption and mismanagement. Frankly, it's not a very appetizing place for good quality investors to invest. And the problem is, if you have corruption and mismanagement in the way that licensing is issued, that creates two problems. Firstly, you have companies who may not have the technical expertise or the financial capital, or indeed the background in terms of protecting the environment and people investing in the country. They simply, you could end up with companies that manage to get licenses through other means without having that technical expertise. And secondly, if licenses are issued through corruption and mismanagement, there's very little incentive for either the government employees or for the companies to adhere to the law. So I think it's remarkable that what you see in Uganda is tens of thousands of people working as artisanal miners in gold mines that are unregulated and unlicensed that pop up across the country in really dangerous conditions. You know, we visited mines in Mbende where people openly talked about their fear of death.
Do you guys have any figures of how much revenue that could go to schools and roads and infrastructure is being lost because of this corruption?
It's very, very difficult to put a figure on it, but certainly there were reports in the Ugandan media that billions of shillings are being lost out on as a result of smuggling. We've seen evidence that of this $200 million worth of gold that left the country between 2015 and 2016, making gold Uganda's second biggest export after coffee, the company, African Gold Refinery, that was processing this gold, only paid $500,000 in tax.
That was Josh Borden, Uganda campaign leader for Global Witness. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. Somalia finds itself in a diplomatic dilemma after Saudi Arabia and several other friendly countries broke ties with Qatar, accusing it of supporting terrorism. Qatar denies the accusations. Both Qatar and Saudi Arabia have close relations with Somalia, and President Farmaajo has visited the two countries in the past 2 weeks. Former Somali Foreign Minister Abdusalam Omar, who made the decisions to side with Saudi Arabia in the past, says any new turbulence in relations between Arab countries is not good for Somalia.
My reaction is it's a sad day that the Arab world and the Islamic world have a lot of challenges. Those challenges include the situation in Syria, in Yemen, in Libya, in Iraq, in Somalia. And I'm sure that we don't need any more activity or negative activity among Arab countries. And I hope cool heads will prevail and it will be concluded soon.
Why do you think Saudi Arabia and other countries have made the decision to cut ties with Qatar?
Well, I think they have their own reasons. They talked about the information that they have received and tensions that have been maybe building up and that we just were not aware of it. Qatar have their own way of explaining the situation. But in whichever way you take it, today is not the day that Arab countries have to fight among each other, because some of our Arab brothers and sisters and Arab countries are in dire need for support, including Somalia, Yemen, Libya, Syria, and Qatar, and I mean Iraq. So really, the reasoning is not important. Why it has been escalated to this point is a question needs to be answered. And I think in the few coming days, we will know all the issues.
And how do you think this might affect Somalia?
These are our brothers, whether it's all the Gulf Cooperation Council are our brothers, other Arab countries are our brothers, they are our Muslim brothers. It's Ramadan. Somalia relies on their support from the GCC countries and for different fields and different occasions and different programs. And any turbulence in that relationship will not be good for Somalia. But I'm sure that the things will sort itself out.
What do you think Somalia should do? Do you think Somalia should take sides or stay neutral?
I think I'll leave that to the president, the prime minister, and the foreign minister. I'm sure they have capable hands and heads to work it out. In general, I should say that we should join those who will make peace among brotherly people in this holy month of Ramadan.
Abdul Salam Omar is Somalia's former foreign minister. He was speaking with Harun Maruf of VOA Somali Service. An alert was issued earlier this month in Mombasa County in Kenya in response to an outbreak of dengue fever, a potentially fatal mosquito-borne disease. Dozens of cases have been diagnosed countrywide, and as Rael Ombua reports from Nairobi, efforts were underway to curb the spread of the disease.
The dengue fever outbreak so far has left more than 100 people infected in Kenya's coastal city of Mombasa, according to the government health officials in the county by the same name. In recent statements, authorities say dengue has spread to different parts of the county, with cases confirmed in major hospitals. The county director of medical services, Dr. Khadija Shikeli, says that according to past statistics, dengue has been more prevalent in Mombasa compared with the rest of Africa. She says children attending school are among those impacted.
In Mombasa, the prevalence of dengue.
Shikeli says that research shows that children who go to school and people attending college, such as teenagers, are the most affected by dengue fever. Shikeli says officials and institutions of learning are working together to clear the mosquitoes' breeding sites. She also says posters have been released and information disseminated via social media to inform people on the various preventive measures. According to the World Health Organization, dengue is transmitted by female mosquito of the Aedes aegypti, the same species that transmits yellow fever and the Zika infection. The infection causes a flu-like illness and occasionally develops into a potentially lethal complication called severe dengue, known also as dengue hemorrhagic fever. The disease is more prevalent in areas that are crowded and unhygienic. Recent rains in the region are said to have created breeding grounds for the insects. Health authorities say dengue was first reported in Mombasa in 2013, with 197 suspected cases. 38 cases were positive. They also said 589 dengue cases were reported last year. Shikeli outlined some efforts taken to control the spread of dengue.
For the last 2 months, before even the rainy season, we have been doing a lot of chlorination.
She says for the past 2 months, even before the start of the rainy season, prevention and control efforts have included a lot of chlorination and a lot of spraying.
That was Rael Ombua reporting from Nairobi. And that is it for this Tuesday, June 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu, host of Health Chat. Join us this Tuesday as we take a look at menstrual health and adolescent girls. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-691-3111. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.